today, you and your wife, and we hope you will come to us again next time you come through town. And
you won't be able to keep me away.
Oh, that's great. Well, we won't lock the door. Craig has been talking about his new novella, The Spirit of Steamboat, comes out today, and you should get it because it's a great book, and you should go see Craig tonight at 7 o'clock at Powell's Cedar Mills Crossing or whatever it is over in Beaverton. You can't miss it. It's the only Powell's in Beaverton, I think. So, Craig and Ms. Johnson, thank you very much for coming by.
My pleasure, Gene.
Okay, take care.
All right, Gene, thank you very much. And Craig, great interview this morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up in just a minute, the second half of Between the Covers with Lisa Loving interviews writer Jesmyn Ward about her new memoir. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose. No good to nobody, no good for nothing. Because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that.
Folk music is one of the first social media communicating news of social import. It still does so today. Join me, Don Jacobson, on Friday, October 25th, 12 noon to 1:30, for Sing Me a Song of Social Significance. From Woody Guthrie to Cy Conn, you'll hear songs that are meaningful to your lives, songs that are inspiring, and songs that are just fun to listen to. Cy Conn and David Rovick's CDs will be available as thank you gifts for your pledge. 12 noon to 1:30, Friday, October 25th, only on KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, Between the Covers. I'm Lisa Loving, and my guest in the studio is Jesmyn Ward, her newest memoir, Men We Reaped. Thank you for being here.
And thank you for having me.
Jesmyn, this book rocked my world. It rocked my world.
Okay.
This is not a casual book.
No.
Okay. Why did you write this book?
I wrote this book because from 2000 and 2004, five young black men in my community died. Right. So the first was my brother, who died in October of 2000. And then one of my friends died in 2002. And then my cousin and two other friends of mine died in 2004. So, you know, during my early 20s, I lost five people that I was really close to. And I couldn't write about that in fiction because it was just too enormous and too great. You know, it took me many years. It took me 10 years from my brother's death before I reached a place where I decided that I could actually write about it, you know, where I had the necessary temporal distance, right, to write about it. And then after sort of gaining my sister's permission in a way, I started. So the book is about, you know, the five young men that I knew that died from 2000, 2004. And it's sort of asking the question, right, like why an epidemic like that would happen in the kind of place that I'm from. So I'm from this really small rural town in Mississippi called DeLille. And then it's using my life and my family's life as context to try to figure out why an epidemic like that would happen, period, really.
When it comes to memoir, sometimes it's difficult because people write about people that are alive and you're not sure what your family's going to think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this book was all about that.
Mm-hmm.
You had to bargain with your family members that are still alive in a way to be able to tell this story because mm-hmm. it's so personal. Then in the end, as I'm reading through it, I almost get the sense that your family needed you to write it.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit, the give and take of getting permission to tell us such a painful family story?
You know, I did get permission from my sisters. And, you know, we're pretty close. We're closer, especially since my brother died, right? So because I talked to them about so much, it was easier for me to go to them, you know, for that permission, for what I needed. Because I didn't even realize that that's what I needed until I asked both of them, what do you think about me writing this book? Honestly, I never went to my mother for that permission. And I didn't go to my father for that permission. And I think part of the reason that I did not do that is because I knew, you know, that they probably would not want me to write the book. Funny enough, my father has had an easier time of adjusting to the fact that I've written the book and an easier time of reading the book. But I think that's just because of his personality, you know, of who he is. My mother has had a much harder time of it. And I think that if she had to choose, it would, like, the book wouldn't exist, you know. And I understand why, you know, and I'm, you know, I've had discussions with her about this, and I've apologized to her for I think hurting her in ways by writing about this and by, you know, exposing some of our family secrets. But I also attempted to explain to her and to other people, you know, in my family and also in the community who, you know, this book is problematic for, that the reason that I tell the truth and write about, you know, expose our secrets is because if we don't talk about it, then nothing changes. And I briefly allude to this at the end of the book, right? Then I'm crippled by worry, right, about my nephew, who's 17, and my niece, you know, who's 7. And I have a baby now. You know, my baby, she's 1, right? So I want us to begin talking about these things because I want them to change. And that's the reason why I told the truth and exposed our secrets here.
The memoir is Men We Reaped. The author, Jesmyn Ward, we're here in the studio with her. This book is like being privileged to be invited into the door of someone's incredibly intimate life where things are hard. You know, some of these, sometimes we'll see memoir that's just like, you know, oh, under the Tuscan sun, you know, and that's not what this book is about. It's about your family and it's about Dalil, mm-hmm. but it's also about America. Mm-hmm. And if you're white, here's a book that you could pick up and begin to understand how there's more than one America and how it is that there's whole communities of people, especially here in Portland, which is famously a very white town, very segregated here. Mm. There's reasons why specifically the African-American community is estranged from the white community because there are things that black people go through that white people will never have to go through. Mm-hmm. Can I put it like that?
Yeah, you can.
Can I ask you to read the names of the men? Is that all right?
Oh, yes.
I feel as though we need to name them and put them in this interview.
Mm-hmm. So Roger Eric Daniels III, Damon Cook, Charles Joseph Martin, Ronald Wayne Lozana, and Joshua Adam Dito.
I'm a middle-aged white lady, and I work at an African-American newspaper, and virtually every African-American person that I know and virtually every African person I know has relatives that have been murdered, virtually every single one. Can you talk a little bit about the big realization that you had as you're putting this book together and that you're really offering through this story, the big realization of what the story is about?
Mm-hmm. As I worked my way through this book and tried to figure out why, you know, why my brother died, why my friends died, why my cousin died. And then also, I think in some ways, tried to figure out why I lived the way that I did when I was younger, or why my community continues to struggle, you know, and why there are still casualties, why in the, you know, the past, what, say 7 years, you know, since, you know, the last of my friends died, the young men, I know 3 young women that have died during those years. And so the realization that I came to was that this isn't just chance. These deaths aren't just the result of chance and of bad luck. That bad luck is born out of racism. It's born out of inequality. It's born out of a culture and a nation that repeatedly tells black people, young black people, especially young black men, that they are worth less, that their bodies don't matter, that their lives don't matter. And because, you know, black people, you know, and specifically young black people continue to get this message over and over and over again, then of course, in some ways, they internalize that message. So then this larger machine, right, sort of narrows their choices. They have a selection of bad choices. So that's happened. And then at the same time, they've internalized this message that the larger world is giving them over and over again. So then they make bad decisions, or they're in the wrong place at the wrong time and they die like my brother did. And then no one is held accountable for his death. You know, if you want to think about that message, right? If you want to see a clear example of that message, then you can just think about the George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin verdict. Right?
There's a story everyone knows.
There's a, exactly. And that is the that's the underlying message that's being sent to young black people, especially young black men. Your life does not matter. You know, you are worth less.
We are in the studio with Jessamyn Ward. We're talking about her memoir, Men We Reaped.
Men We Reaped, a story of an author Jessamyn Ward, and the tragedy that she's experienced firsthand with people that were close to her because she grew up in an environment that taught them, those young men, that teaches people that their lives don't matter. But we're here to help remind us all that our lives do matter. And the way that you can do that now is by helping to support this station in getting this type of message out there. And you do it by calling 877-500-5266. That's a toll-free number right here. Next to me, we have people on the phone ready to take your calls at 877-500-5266. You can go on the internet at kbo.fm. That works as well. You can come down and visit us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. We've had some people just walk in a couple of times this morning to make their pledge to us, because what we're working against, even though it isn't apparent every moment, is this wolf that Ms. Ward talks about, the wolf that tracked all of these young men. And that wolf is the sense of how little their lives mattered. Your support for KBOO at 877-500-5266 helps to resist these type of attitudes being forced down people's throats and helps them to resist internalizing this type of thinking. And what I want you to internalize right now is this number, 877-500-5266. You pick up your phone, you make that call, you become part of this piece of the resistance. We're here because we have a passion for this type of action, for this type of activism, if you will, or as a friend of the station, Brian Wilson, likes to refer to it, it's just being a human being. And I'm asking you to be a human being. Show us that you care. Show us that this matters to you by calling 877-500-5266. That's the number here at KBOO. It's toll-free. Let's keep it toll-free by helping us to meet our goal and keep the station moving forward, charging forward, keep this momentum going. We have some thanks to give out to our food donors. That's Pine State Biscuits at 3640 Southeast Belmont Street, Bamboo Grove Hawaiian Grill at 0515 Southwest Carolina Street, B-Saws at 2301 Northwest Xavier Street. They have pitched in with their part. Now you pitch in with yours. It's a simple phone call. It's 877-500-5266 and KBOO.fm. We're going back to Lisa Loving and her guest Jessamyn Ward, Men We Reaped on Between the Covers.
We are in the studio with Jessamyn Ward. We're talking about her memoir, Men We Reaped. The title of the book comes from a quote from Harriet Tubman, and it's followed in the front of the book by some rhymes from Tupac Shakur, some poetry from Tupac Shakur. Can you read the Harriet Tubman and then the Tupac Shakur and talk about why you chose those? I mean, I bet they would have really had a lot to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We saw the lightning, and that was the guns. And then we heard the thunder, and that was the big guns. And then we heard the rain falling, and that was the blood falling. And when we came to get in the crops, it was dead men that we reaped. And that's Harriet Tubman. Young adolescents in our prime live a life of crime. Though it ain't logical, we hobble through these trying times. Living blind, Lord help me with my troubled soul. Why all my homies had to die before they got to grow. From Words to My Firstborn by Tupac Shakur.
This book is hard to read, but I couldn't put it down, okay? Here, let's talk about your mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
When I thought about your mom and dad, they reminded me of my mom and dad. Mm-hmm. And I could just picture them in my mind, like in the 50s, and they were good looking.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a lot of things going for them. Mm-hmm. Talk about your family. How did your parents set you guys up when you were growing up? And what were the struggles your parents had?
Mm-hmm. My father, during his teenage years, lived in Oakland.
Oakland,
California. His family was relocated after the last big hurricane before Katrina. So it was Hurricane Camille in 1969. So his family was relocated to Oakland, California. So my dad spent his junior high and his high school years there, right? And then when my mother graduated from high school, she briefly moved to Los Angeles, and then she went to the Bay Area and joined my dad. And that's when they really, you know, sort of cemented their relationship. And then I came along pretty quickly. You know, I was born when my mom was 18 and my dad was 20. You know, so they were really young parents. And then my brother was born around 2 years and some change after that. My second sister, Narissa, she was born 2 years after my brother. And then my last sister, Shireen, or my last full sister, Shireen, was born 2 years after that. When I was three, we moved back to Mississippi. I think there was a freedom that she encountered in California and in the Bay Area that she didn't have in Mississippi, because I think that she was very aware of how the South sort of limited her options, you know, and made it harder for her to support a family, to have a family.
She wanted to go to school. She wanted to go to college, but she couldn't. And in California, she mm-hmm. could maybe find a more affordable place to live. She could yep. get a job, yep. and people would support the idea, even mm-hmm. just the concept that she would want that.
Yep.
But back in Mississippi, mm-hmm. it was like, no.
No. No, I mean, even something just as simple as, you know, she was taking classes at a community college while she was in California. That community college had a preschool. You know, if you were a student, your kid could just go there for nothing or a little bit of nothing. And that was the case. Whereas in Mississippi, you know, there's no investment in that kind of like civic service. You know, it makes sense to me that those kinds of programs make sense to me. And then, but of course, that kind of stuff, you know, it does not at community colleges where I'm from. It's not part of what is offered. So, yeah, I mean, there were certain things that she could do in California and that she couldn't do in Mississippi. But my dad really wanted to come home, which is interesting to me because my father, you know, they have very different personalities. My mother has always been more reserved than my father, you know, and she's very hardworking. My dad is really hardworking too, but it's easier for him to be more affectionate, to express himself. He's something of an eccentric, I think, and I hope that I communicate that in the book, where my mother is more sort of buttoned up and, you know, a little bit more conservative, right? And my father really isn't. So we moved back to Mississippi when I was three, and I think in the end that it was probably a bad decision for my family. I think that my father underestimated how hard it was going to be to be an adult black man in the South, having to bear the pressure of, you know, being the breadwinner, having a family of, you know, six people, including himself, that he had to take care of. And I think it would have been easier for him, you know, if we decided to stay in California. I think staying in California would have given him a little bit of what he wanted, right? Because I think he wanted a sense of freedom. My dad's always been in love with a sense of possibility. He's always been a dreamer, you know, and I think that, you know, having that kind of constitution and actually realizing some of what he wanted to realize would have been a bit easier if they'd stayed in California, if we'd all stayed in California.
One of the things that hurt you and maybe also hurt your mom and hurt mm-hmm. your family was the way your father felt like he had to be harder on the son.
Mm-hmm.
We see that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But talk about that a little bit, like the idea that your dad had to be harder on your mm-hmm. brother so that your brother would have the tough mm-hmm. to tough it out where they were. Talk about that a little. Where does that yeah. come from?
I mean, I think that my dad knew, especially once we were living there, right? And my brother was actually born in Mississippi. So my dad, he knew what it meant to be a black man in the South, you know, and here he has this son. It's his only son so far. And then it ended up being, you know, his only son, at least with our family, right? And here was this boy, you know, who would grow up to be a black man in the South. And so I think that my father felt like he had to prepare my brother for that. He had to toughen him up for that. You know, he had to make him resilient and make him into a fighter and really make him able to deal with the harshness, deal with, like, you know, the violence, I guess, that can occur, you know, especially to, you know, black men in the South. And so I think that's, you know, one of the reasons that he was harder on my brother than he was on us.
And to be fair, when I look at the stories of all of the men that you're writing about, your brother, I'm not going to say that he had broken through, but he found a place where he was legal and he was legally employed and he was enjoying it. And he was run off the road by a drunk driver, a white man that was never charged with anything at all. Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about the four men that you write about, because really the point of this book is why it makes a difference if you're African-American and not white. Talk about these, actually, every one of these men, they reminded me of my family. I know that our families aren't the same, but where my family, they live in the central San Joaquin Valley, and they drive a lot, and they drink a lot, and they smoke stuff that I don't even know what it is, and I don't know if they know what it is. But talk a little bit about what it was that that killed these men, and how is it that if they were somewhere else or someone else, that wouldn't have happened, like Roger, Raj.
You know, I think about Raj, and I think about the fact that, you know, that before he died, especially in the months before he died, he really wanted to leave Mississippi again. A few years earlier, he'd moved to Los Angeles. He'd lived with cousins that he had in Los Angeles, and he loved it. And he did well, but then something drew him back home. Then he returned to Mississippi, and unfortunately, he developed a problem with addiction, right? And he began to use, you know, harder drugs than alcohol and marijuana. It was something that he was ashamed of, that he fought, you know, that he, you know, tried to stop doing, but it was difficult for him. And I think that when I look at his life, when I look at my life, when I look at, you know, the lives of a lot of the young men that I write about in this book, and then just in general in my community, you know, I feel like that we're self-medicating when we do what we do, when we develop problems with addiction. You know, I mean, of course we don't have access to, like, good mental health care. We don't have access to any mental health care at all.
We are in the studio with Jessamyn Ward. We're talking about her memoir, Men We Reaped.
And we have copies of that memoir available to you for only a $60 minimum pledge. That's our sustaining level. That's $5 a month. Make that pledge by calling us at 877-500-5266. You can get your very own cover hard copy of Men We Reaped by Jessamyn Ward. But the way that you do that is by picking up the phone and calling 877, it's toll free, 500-5266.
Or you can go to the web. If you're listening to us over the internet, you can go to kboo.fm and also sign up, become a member there, or renew your pledge.
And we have a renewing member. Good job, Debbie, out in Portland for renewing. She picked up the phone. She called us at 877-500-5266. She made the pledge. She let us know that it matters to her. It's more than just the money. It's the passion, it's the love, it's the investment, it's recognizing what KBOO represents to the community. And this talk with Jessamyn Ward should give you a good counterpoint. When you don't have this type of social fabric weaving things together, you get people on a wide scale who just, they think that their lives don't matter, and a lot stems from that. But you out there who's listening to me right now, you haven't called in yet, I want you to do it right now at 877-500-5266. Recognize what KBOO does for your community and recognize your part in keeping us strong and moving forward.
And think about it this way. KBOO has been a forerunner, pushing the edges of broadcast media in the Portland metropolitan area for 45 years. You would not have heard about a lot of these issues 40 years ago unless you listened to KBOO. You would not have heard anyone on the air, on radio, or in television in the Portland metro area who wasn't white unless you listened to KBOO. So KBOO has always been on the leading edge of social change, about knitting our community together, whoever we are, wherever we live, whatever our status. So call us at 877-500-5266. Be part of the community that we are, that transcends the face-to-face relationships we have. 877-500-5266. Make a pledge. Support us. Be part of be part of what has made Portland pretty great as a city in terms of livability. Think about how KABU has been part of the cultural underpinnings of who we are today. 500-5266, 877-500-5266. That's where you can call. There's several people here who would be so happy to hear your voice. Your voice. You've been hearing ours. Let us hear yours.
877-500-5266. Make that call. We're going strong. We've got an incredibly powerful pledge drive going. Things are rocking and rolling. Come be part of it. Step up. Step up to the phone. 877-500-5266.
We are in the studio with Jessamyn Ward. We're talking about her memoir, Men We Reaped. Let's just take another minute to talk about some of the other ways that these men in your life passed away.
Mm-hmm. So Raj, he had a hereditary heart condition, right? He could never really play sports. He couldn't play football or anything like that because of the condition. But then, as I just said, he developed a problem with drug addiction. And so some people think that that aggravated his condition, and he ended up dying of a heart attack.
He had a heart attack. He was 26 or something like that.
Very young.
How about Damon?
Damon, he was shot. He was shot and killed. He was coming home from work. He was in his yard, actually, and someone hid there and waited for him to come home, and then they shot him. His murder hasn't been solved. In the community, people think that because he'd agreed to testify against a drug dealer, that's the reason that he was killed.
How about Charles?
Charles. So CJ, he was in a car. He was riding up country with our cousin and then a friend. And the car that he was in, there was a very thick, heavy winter fog. And unfortunately, the intersection where they were crossing the train tracks, there's no reflective arm, you know, that
no
lowers.
Warning infrastructure for anyone there that there's a train coming.
Exactly. And the lights that are there often malfunction. Sometimes they don't work. Sometimes they, you know, they shine when there isn't even a train. And so the car that he was in hit the train and he died. He's in the passenger seat.
He had been out. He was doing a favor for someone. He was doing a Samaritan.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just going to run out and get Salvage the Bones, which is the novel you wrote that won the National Book Award. Mm-hmm. And that's where I want to ask you. Now, Salvage the Bones is a story. It's a novel about a family and how they survived Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. As we are talking about your life story, Hurricane Camille totally had an impact on your life. And then so did Katrina. Mm-hmm. What is this with the environment? You have a love-hate relationship. You do.
I have
a love-hate relationship with Mississippi and with the environment. Talk about that.
Yes, I do. Mississippi, it's a merciless place in many ways, you know, and I feel that way in regards to the hurricanes, you know, these powerful hurricanes that come like clockwork once every 30 years, the smaller hurricanes that we deal with in the interim. You know, we deal with hurricanes throughout the entire season, you know, that they spin out in the Gulf and threaten us, and just because of where we're at, right? You know, and then in relation to CJ's story, I often think about that fog. Because with his death especially, sometimes I feel like Mississippi killed him. You know, not only like the negligence of, you know, the people in charge, the politicians, the people in charge of infrastructure, right? But then also just the landscape itself made it possible for him to die.
But now you've gone back there.
Now,
yes, I have. You could have been in New York. You could be in LA. Mm-hmm. You could be anywhere. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose to go back home?
So I'm working on another novel. I have no idea what it will be by the time I'm done. I went back because of my family, and not only just my mom and my sisters and my niece and my nephew, but also I went back because of my extended family. I have a really huge extended family. Just counting my maternal grandmother's family, there's over 200 of us. I went home so I could experience that sense of community, and then I also went back home to fight the good fight.
Jessamyn Ward, the memoir is Men We Reaped. I just really want to thank you for coming to Portland, and I hope you come again, and we're really going to look forward to it.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Between the Covers. Stay tuned.
It's time for the KABU News at Noon for Thursday, October 17th. Last night, U.S. legislators negotiated a deal to reopen the federal government. The debt ceiling has been lifted until February 2014. According to a new report released this week by Walk Free Foundation regarding modern slavery around the world, 30 million people live in bondage. The list ranks countries in total numbers of slaves and also by proportion. India ranks fourth and contains 14 million slaves. Mauritania ranks number one with the largest proportion of slaves, 4% of the population of the West African country are enslaved. Many of the 150,000 slaves are born into bondage. Iceland, Ireland, and the UK are at the very bottom of the list. However, the index reports that there are at least 4,000 people living as slaves in the UK. The index also reveals that 1 in 10 Haitian children are exploited for labor. For more, visit www.walkfreefoundation.org. A U.S. activist will undergo a nasal tube feeding to protest the deplorable conditions at Guantanamo Bay Prison tomorrow. The display will happen at the U.S. District Court building in Washington, D.C. Andres Thomas Contreras fasted for 103 days so far, consuming nothing but water. The 52-year-old man demonstrated force feeding in places like Oakland and at various U.S. embassies around the world. Contreras lost 57 pounds and says that when undergoing nasal gastric force feeding, it feels as though you are drowning. 16 men at Guantanamo Bay are striking and get force fed. The U.S. federal government continues to deny Oregon's same-sex couples who are registered as domestic partners a tax break, despite the fact that the couples of the opposite sex in civil unions are considered married for tax purposes. Gay couples in Illinois and Oregon qualify for state tax breaks, but not federal. Gay couples wishing to acquire the tax break may apply for a license in another state, like California or Washington, for as little as $35 to get the desired income tax status. A prison riot in Grants Pass, Oregon, caused $100,000 in damage